People like to talk about motor control and movement patterns and activating certain muscles and patterning and retraining through sequencing. We're going to talk about how movement is more of a behavioral and an emergence perspective on this week's episode of
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
The intro thing kills me. It's like I've grabbed the attention of some of you that haven't watched this before, but
I love it.
It's so forced. The motor control people out there, the people that try to have that be the answer to every problem that they see. And also that perspective of just thinking about something being dysfunctional or broken is too much of like a levers and pulleys.
It's a reductionist perspective.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. It's reductionist.
It's very structural reductionist. Yeah.
Right. So we're going to talk a bit of today about what motor control is. We're going to try to approach this from the perspective that the motor control people out there is going to try to come at this model for, or any model that might be talking about emergence and energetics. There are some aspects, obviously, to what they're saying that are helpful and useful. So we don't want to completely throw the baby out with the bathwater, but there's a lot to consider about that, using that type of reductionist approach to try to isolate. For instance, if someone has a hip internal rotation issue, only going after the glute medius, as that's the only thing that if I get this muscle to fire in this order and you do, you move your arm and leg in this way, then you will fix your movement dysfunction. And I'm making air quotes for everyone listening.
Yeah. Yeah. It's deservative air quotes.
So let's talk about, we've both been exposed to this concept and we've learned it along the way. Anytime you're learning kinesiology, it's a lot of motor control, top down motor learning. I guess let's talk about the traditional perspective first and then what we need to reconsider about it.
So I think one of the reasons why it's such a strong representation in whatever movement profession that you may be in is because if you don't know anything, it seems very reasonable, because we have valued the input of the brain as the master controller. And so that's very easy to grasp. It's like, oh, I have this computer and it tells the body exactly what to do. And then that creates isolated structure. And if I can reduce something to isolated structure, I can learn this in bytes. And that's easy to learn. There's my air quotes. Easy to learn, right? And then I can place blame, and then I can default to structure, and then my solutions appear to be very simple, and then I can seem really, really smart, like to myself. Now, I don't really care like how it's presented, but I would feel smart because then I would have an understanding of something that is crazy complex, right? And so I think that's one of the reasons why, because if you go back. Let me think, 70 years now. And you go back to like the PNF as a foundational kind of a representation. Like that was a very complex, systemically driven system, right? Useful, still useful, not perfect, but still very useful as a representation. And then take bits and pieces of that, which is what people did, is they broke pieces off of PNF. And then they go, oh, we could do this in isolation, right? And then that's where you got like all of the isolated stretches, right? And then Yanda comes along like 10 years, 15 years later. And then he goes, this is this neurophysiological representation. And then he starts to show some of these representations as a whole. He presented them as a whole. And then this got broken down into, oh, I have something that's tight, and then I have something that's weak, right? And then that got sold in bits and pieces. And then bodybuilding becomes very popular. And now we superimpose that, and then we train body parts. And then that became a very strong foundation for how people exercise, So we exercise in parts. And then so we have this sort of like unfortunate, perfect storm of the brain is the master controller. It moves all the pieces and parts. And all I got to do is manage the pieces and parts that aren't listening to the brain for some reason, right? When the reality is like the brain is certainly a contributor by all, inputs, but it's not the master controller. It's just a participant. It's a modulator, right? It helps us adjust things, certainly, but it is not the primary solution maker as it would be perceived, which is very strongly towards the motor control perspective. And I'm not going after, when we talk about this, we're not going after the people that are studying the behavior of the brain relative to movement. We're talking more about like how this is represented in the movement profession industries, if you will. And I think, but again, I think that what has happened, it's like it's become this oversimplification of a representation, because the people that don't have a strong scientific foundation can grasp onto this and they can talk about it, which is why it gets perpetuated the way it does. And so, you know, if you have a certification that took you 30 days to pass, or you could literally go online and do it in like an hour, probably at this point, but. And if you didn't come from a science background, you don't have foundational sciences under your belt. It's like, well, what are you going to fall back on? Well, I'll fall back on what everybody else talked about, and then they're going to give me the unfortunately dumbed down version of that, and then that's what I will tell the next person, and then the next person, and the next person, and the next thing you know, it's prolific. Now, prolific doesn't mean correct; it just means that. That's the broad perspective of an audience, right? And it certainly doesn't make it correct. But like, again, I think it comes down to a simplicity. It's easy. Like take a client of yours. Like they walk in the door and they're thinking, my brain runs the show. And it's like, so what would make sense to them? Right. And then, you know, you take a coach or a trainer that, like I said, doesn't have the scientific background, he's thinking the same thing. So it makes sense to them, right? So why would they question it, right? Because it seems to be the representation. They get lucky enough through execution that they do get some favorable results, and then that reinforces it. Because they do the right thing by accident, not through intention, right? They do have some behavior that arises from the activities that they're pursuing that does appear to be favorable. But when you look at it on a much larger scale over a longer period of time with a little bit more foundational science under your belt, with a little bit more experience, you go, this really doesn't fit the model as far as what they're saying. Like, this isn't really reality. And this is why we have to go back, and we have to sort of grab a hold of this concept of complexity and try to understand it to the best of our ability, because this is a much closer representation of reality.
Yeah. So let's talk understanding of what movement is and why it's not so much this top down brain driven thing.
Uh-huh. Like as far as like what is the contributor?
Yeah, so if the motor control crowd is saying that as long as you give the brain this sequence of muscles firing,
right,
then the movement will be functional again, or it will be properly performed,
right,
without pain or any type of negative secondary consequence. Yes. How is that? What are they missing there about how energy flows and movement works?
Okay, so here's what we do know, and you can default to Nikolai Bernstein for this. He's the guy that said repetition without repetition. Okay, so here's what we know: is you cannot do the same thing the exact same way twice. So it's not even possible, which immediately should make you say, "Well, wait a minute, the brain's driving the show, and we can't do the same thing twice." Then we have to start to question that representation, because then everything that's not the thing would be perceived as error, right? It's like there would be a way that this would be executed, right, successfully, and then everything else would be an error. And we don't do that. What we have is variation within a range, and that is what we would refer to as a successful outcome, right? So that's your signal versus noise kind of a representation. We have a signal, and then there's a plus or minus of a certain amount of variation, which is actually very healthy within a certain range. Outside of a certain range, it becomes very unhealthy. If you don't have enough noise and you have way too much signal, you're very fragile. And that's where a lot of potential for destruction occurs. Right. And so again, it just doesn't jibe with the reality of our variation on a theme. Take something like connective tissue as an element of movement. Connective tissue behaves all by itself relative to the energy that is applied to it. It changes its stiffness. It changes its extensibility, right? It translates energy. It provides sensation. And again, no brain included here in that respect. And so it's like, so if I have this stuff that behaves based on the energetic input without the brain's input. Now it can tune it because again, the brain is a modulator. Okay. But it's not the decision maker. So the brain says, oh, we got way too much sensation here. We need to modulate some of the motor output. So we stay within a certain range of variation for whatever it is we're doing. Now you have my attention as far as like that's a coordinative, like non-singular governor type of behavior, which is what we are talking about. Like in a favorable way versus the motor control, which is the default is like the brain's running the show.
Right. Like the brain is in some sort of control room pushing buttons to make muscles fire instead of the brain responding to constraints and different environments and inputs.
Right. Right. Like I said, it modulates the activities. It's the tuner. It's like it's not driving the show. It's just making sure that like enough stuff is organized so it stays within certain range. And you make mistakes all the time, obviously, right? But again, it's like we can't think about how slow everything would be if the brain had to make all of those decisions and then execute. It's like we wouldn't be able to move.
Well, there would be no fluidity to anything.
Not at all. It's like, you make a graceful hand gesture. Like it's the connective tissues behaving that actually make this look like a slow, graceful, flowy kind of a thing. Otherwise there would be like this, like ataxic kind of a shaky movement, like all the time. So, again, it's like it just doesn't seem to fit what is the closest thing to reality.
Right. So let's, I guess, talk a bit about the words that get thrown around a lot about activation or sequencing or patterning. How do we replace or refine that terminology to make it fit with how movement actually works? I guess the things that I'm thinking about are utilizing shape change and understanding the flow of fluids, just to let people understand that, a wave form will look like, it's very quantum. When you're talking about particle and wave behavior, the particle behavior is at any point in time, when you measure something, you'll be at a point in space. So that I think is part of the reason that people can get so confused about patterns and activation sequences and stuff like that versus a waveform and energy flowing through the body and fluids crashing and swirling and twisting like water. I think if you understand dynamically how movement works with the flow of fluids and stuff like that, it becomes harder to try to say that if I'm pouring a fluid down a hill, I don't have to activate the fluid. There isn't any, I don't have to send any sort of signal to water to flow downhill. It just will flow down the hill based on the gradient created.
Right.
So I think maybe we can try to talk about that, why those things are so different.
Well, the shape changes represent the gradients. Therefore there is movement, right? So, and we were talking about this, is like, well, you move in the direction of expansion, right? So it's just like when we talk about humans, generally speaking, we're talking about pressure related gradients, which would be in fluid, whether we're talking about air, or whether we're talking about water, it doesn't really matter. They're both fluids, right? And so the shape changes that we're seeing are just a representation of the gradient. But the reason that they exist, the reason the shape change occurs, is you're just solving a problem. And that's it. Whether it be like, you look at somebody just standing, right? And everybody would say, well, you're looking at static posture. And I would argue it's like, no, you're looking at a constrained movement, right? They are actually resisting a behavior. Right, you're seeing a manifestation of a strategy to solve a problem, because you're breathing, everything inside of you is moving, and you need to manage all of that and remain bipedal. You are solving a problem, and so that's what we see. So we're never really looking at something that is static per se,
right? Unless you're dead.
Well, and there you go. And then it's like, okay, there's no heartbeat, there's no breathing, there's no gut movement, right? I don't have to stand up. I am on a slab, if you will, or whatever it might be. And that's a totally different representation of what is reality, right?
Maybe.
So we're just solving problems. That's why you see the differences in shapes. That's why you see a twist in the knee. That's why you see a funky looking elbow. That's why you see what appears to be an indentation in a rib cage when somebody's just standing in front of you. That's why you see the anterior orientation of the pelvis. They're solving a problem, right? That is not a dysfunction, right? It is a solution in context based on the constraints. Okay. And then again, it's like, that doesn't require, I mean, it's an interaction, right? But it's not a computerized control feature, right?
Right. I believe some of the problems about learning this stuff early on come from static representations, learning anatomy based on pictures off of a skeleton that doesn't move, off of anatomical models that are stuck in one position,
right?
Off of cadavers that seem to work like levers and pulleys when you pull on tendons and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
But understanding that when there's movement, and you're talking about gut movement, you're talking about fluids moving through the body at all times, us trying to move forward through space, the water trying to flow downhill, depending on where we are within our center of gravity. It's tough to reconcile that with these other frameworks that I think people are given early on.
Yes.
And I think a takeaway from all of this is we're not just poo-pooing the motor control people, because I believe a lot of them have tools that are very useful.
Sure.
It's just that the framework in which they're applying the tools is not correct.
Right.
It's not coherent with everything else.
There's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with any of the exercises. There's nothing wrong with any of the manual techniques. There's nothing wrong with programming per se, right? It's like the why, like the reasoning behind it. And like, if we have a better understanding of the how, then the why sort of presents itself, and then our decision making is infinitely better.
Yeah,
we truly have alternatives to provide more options for solutions, because that's the goal. See, here's the thing. It's like when you default to like the motor control perspective or pieces and parts kind of a thing, it's like you have a corrective, like you're trying to fix something. The reality is, it's like, we're not trying to fix something. What we're trying to do is we're trying to increase the access to more options. And that's not the same thing. It's like, the more options that I can give the system, right, the more likely you are to execute closer to the ideal, Now, you might not ever be able to produce the ideal, but you have more options to do so. That's the goal.
Yeah.
Right. It's not to create the better one. It's to create more of them so that the signal can be truly represented. Right. And again, that's a plus or minus within a certain range. Right. To, again, depending on context, depending on the desired outcome.
Sure, because health and performance desired outcomes will put you in a different range.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And a performance related intent or outcome that you're looking for may put you outside of that range of adaptability, but for a very specific purpose. And that's not what we're talking about here. Yeah. People try to compare the two. That's why the unified health and performance continuum model, that's why that's called that.
Yes.
Because they're not the same things. They exist on this continuum.
Yes.
And in many cases, the optimal version of either cannot exist in the same place at the same time.
Correct. Correct.
So that's something, because a lot of people that would talk about why, people that don't understand this model or haven't learned it, look at it and say, well, they don't train hard, or they think everything is about breathing and laying on the ground. And that's not true. What we're trying, circling back to what Bill was saying about, this really boils down to potential and kinetic energy. We're talking about energetics. If you don't have the space to move into first, you will have to find a way to put your foot on the ground or to throw a ball. Because that's the task that you're given. So what we're trying to say is, in terms of this adaptability and these options we're trying to create, that's something that needs to precede any type of action that you're trying to undertake, I guess, would be a good way to put it.
Well, from a protective circumstance, right?
Yeah. For sure.
Again, it's because, and again, this is the big challenge, and this is always a tough question when you're working with somebody that's more like on the strength and conditioning side and fitness side, because people have goals or they want to achieve a level of performance, and it's like, well, there's trade-off here, right? So we just used this the other day. It's like, if I have a baseball pitcher that, you know, is throwing 96 miles an hour, that's awesome, but let's just say we make this amazing change and he now throws 105. To do that, he may have pushed himself up to a threshold where he doesn't have that variation plus or minus anymore. The signal is so strong that that gives him this amazing level of performance, but one tick in the wrong direction and then you have like destruction, right?
Yeah.
It's like walking up to the edge of a cliff. And you're perfectly safe. As long as you don't step off the cliff, you are perfectly fine. So you don't even see this coming because it doesn't seem like anything. It's like, I just get a little bit closer, a little bit closer, a little bit closer, a little bit closer, a little bit closer. I'm safe. I'm good. I don't feel anything, whatever it is. And then one nudge and then you're off the edge of the cliff. And then that's where bad things happen. And like, then that's called a threshold. And so you cross that threshold. And that's what we have to be protective of. And the way we do that over time is the way that we structure things is through our data collection, if you will. It's like measures and tracking key performance indicators and things like that. And even then, right, we can still make mistakes. Like, I'm not saying that this is a perfection, but it does give us a model from which to work and make better decisions.
Yeah. And the measures that we're taking with the UHPC model and the tests that the dynamic complex movements we're looking at to try to assess someone, we're trying to figure out where that person is at within their base of support or outside their base of support.
Yes.
And that will show us which direction the gradient of movement is happening.
Yes.
The flow of movement is happening.
Or not.
Or not happening.
Or not.
Right. Yes. So if I have no range of motion on the table and my position is very much pushed in one very twisted direction, say like very far forward and to the right, for instance, I don't have any sort of options anymore. So that type of person, you can't necessarily just train them and give them exercises and then hope for the best, because it's going to hurt. most likely. Well, or they're just not going to be able to move.
Yeah. I mean, potentially you're sort of piling on, as it were, to the potential problems.
Yeah. So it's the, I want to try as a last bit here to try to take a scenario, like, let's say we have someone who's having, let's say, right knee pain when they walk around and they get up and sit down from a chair. A more traditional motor control perspective might look at ankle mobility and hip mobility, see if they are limited, and then chase certain muscle activation in order to try to fix the knee issue. So for instance, you'll see someone do a band walk to try to work the glute medius, or do terminal knee extensions to try to get the VMO to turn on, or do a knee to wall tapping drill to try to mobilize their ankle. And these tools could be utilized in order to get us to where we want to go. And it might actually help alleviate this person's symptoms.
Yes.
But it's not necessarily because we're getting that person's brain to fire these muscles. It's more about how we've let movement and a different sort of behavior response emerge as they move.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess elaborate a
redistribution.
Bit
yeah. Well, you have a redistribution and a redirection of the flow of energy through the system.
Sure. Okay.
So this is mechanical energy, right? So as you were stating, it's like potential kinetic energy, right? So if I have a shape, right, at the knee, every time I take a step forward, every time I push into the ground, I have this transfer of energy. I have energy that comes from below to up and then from up to down, right? And so if I have this shape that directs the energy into a space and that energy cannot be easily distributed, then it accumulates, right? So imagine a wave on a beach going into like a rocky kind of a shore, and the wave comes in and it crashes against it and it splashes back and away, okay? Versus I have a wave that comes up on a beach, it kind of rolls up on the beach kind of gracefully and like easily, and then it just kind of rolls away. Okay, so we have two representations, one definitely more high energy, kind of violent looking, the other one just kind of smooth and graceful and relaxed, right? And so if I have a situation where this is the wave slamming into the rocky shore and splashing all over the place, and it hits the same place over and over and over again, and it doesn't get distributed, there will be a change. There will be a change in that over time, that rocky surface would change, okay? Which would be sort of destructive, if you will. So now we imagine the same kind of a thing happening at the knee joint. So I have energy that's coming up from the ground. I have a position of the knee that doesn't redirect this energy that's flowing through the extremity well, and it does accumulate, and it hits like a certain place over and over and over and over and over again. And then eventually this starts to create a situation of salience where the brain actually kind of gets information from that area and goes, hey, something interesting is really happening down here at the knee. Not sure what it is, but I don't know if I like it or not. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you that there's something wrong here. And it says, I'm going to make this hurt. Doesn't mean that there's anything damaged. Doesn't mean there's anything broken. Just means that there's something interesting going on there. Okay. And you might need to do something about it. And that's kind of how something like that would start. But that can be, we can evaluate how this energy is propagating through the system by our measures, by the behaviors, by symptom, by observation through complex movements. And then we can make a determination whether the strategy is an influence in this behavior. Because all we have to do is we run the experiment, we make a change. If the change is favorable, guess what happens? The behavior, the observed behavior, is different. The reported behavior, the subjective, is different. That then becomes like a favorable representation of what we're talking about, right? Now, on the outside, the process doesn't look a whole lot different, right? But our reasoning is different. And so we can be more successful more frequently by addressing it using a model that's closer to reality.
Yeah, and it's going back to my example of those three activities that I talked about. There are a lot of people that will just use those activities. It works for them, making air quotes there. And they won't care to sort of understand why it might actually be working. Or they'll just use this structural reductionist model and continue to do it. But what we're trying to offer with this podcast, just as a way to reconsider what's going on, is maybe it is just about that better distributed weight within someone's center of gravity. So if I'm doing a band, if I wrap a band around above my knee, and I'm having someone take side steps or walk forward or backwards, I'm not going to let them perform the activity on their toes with their heels off the ground or rolled out onto the outsides of their feet. Mm-hmm. Probably going to correct them to push through their whole foot as they move across the ground. So by doing just that specific activity, I may have moved someone within their center of gravity.
Sure, absolutely.
So it's not even about... Also, potentially, I could be influencing the bend in the femur by putting the band above the knee.
Sure.
Potentially.
Well, but here's the problem with that. It's like the story that you told yourself is that my intention is to do this.
Therefore, to fire.
I do this activity. Yeah. But the reality, like the reality that produces a desired outcome is something totally different. But your explanation for it is this structural reductionist representation. Then you carry that over to the next one. And then when it doesn't work, well, wait a minute. Well, why were you wrong this time?
Right. You just shrug your shoulders and then you punt to somebody else.
Right. Because... And then you do it again and it doesn't work. And then you do it again and it does work. So now you're 50-50, right? And you go, okay, well, you know, if you had a cancer drug that would work, 50% of the time, it'd be a miracle. So you kind of stick with it. Right.
Yeah.
And you get enough successes, and enough pats on your own back that you go, I don't need to change. I don't need to learn anything else. These guys are FOS. And it's like, and that's fine too. If you're happy with where you are and you're not, inflicting, misery on anybody, then okay. And it's like, I can't change that. I'm not going to try to change that. We're offering a perspective.
Yeah. And a lot of the times, when someone has a complaint about something, say, and they come to one of us and they say, my right knee has been bothering me a lot, we have to ask them questions to sort of interrogate it. When is one of the important questions. When is your knee bothering you? Oh, whenever I walk up and downstairs. So the first reaction that a lot of people are going to have, or a question they're going to have to their trainer or therapist, is what can I stretch or strengthen in order to, or what exercise can we do? What foam roller thing can I do? When the real question should be, let's watch you walk up and down the stairs. That's always where I try to go when it comes to that type of thing. Or you ask them and you figure out, oh, well, whenever I'm playing with my grandkids and I get up off the ground, my left back hurts. And then you watch them get up off the ground and it's painfully obvious once you see it, not to them, but to you. Yes. And that's where you sort of fix it. And that's, I think, where that might be a confusion for the motor control crowd, is that they think they just corrected how someone moved and the sequence in which that person moved, and that fixed their back issue. It's not really that. It's you helped them figure out a way to better manage their cells within their center of gravity and also distribute the energy like we were talking
it's always a systemic representation.
Versus it's
the,
never
the isolative solution.
Right. It's not levers, it's not parts, it's not gears and nuts and bolts. It's a system that works together.
Yeah.
And it's an emergent sort of behavior.
Yeah.
It is not functional or dysfunctional.
Right.
It's not motor control.
It's just what is. It's always, here you go, it's always a solution.
Yeah, it's a resolution, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, okay, it might not be the desirable one, but it does solve a problem, at least temporarily.
Yeah, it's an organization, a reorganization. It's shape change. It's pressure shifting. It's it's adaptive strategy is a good word. Strategies, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Behaviors, emergence,
yeah. Yeah.
Gradients, all of these things. So hopefully that helps kind of clear things up, maybe give people some information to talk about when it comes to having discussions and conversations about this model with the motor control folks, because they tend to be very stuck in that paradigm from my experience.
If they become satisfied with,
right, and, yeah.
with that understanding, then you know, that's what perpetuates.
I was going to say, and if for them, if they've been doing something for 15, 20 years and it works enough for them to be okay with the strikeouts that they have sometimes.
Yeah.
It is very easy. Cognitive dissonance is very easy to just chalk up a failure to something that's out of your control, right?
Right, right.
But yeah, if anyone's listening this long in the podcast, they're not one of those people anyways. So congratulations to you.